Back in May, I, along with 800 WNYC listeners, sat down with three great French chefs in the Great Hall of Cooper Union for a wonderful conversation. Jacques Pepin, Daniel Belou, and Eric Ripert were all born and raised in France, but they've chosen to make their homes here, finding fame and fortune in kitchens far from the ones where they first learned to love food and to make food. Jacques Pepin has been teaching Americans how to cook for over three decades on television and in many, many cookbooks, including Essential Pepin. Daniel Belou has more than a dozen restaurants around the world, including his exquisite flagship restaurant, Daniel. His most recent book is Braise. And Eric Ripert has restaurants in Philadelphia, Washington, and the Cayman Islands, in addition to the wonderful Le Bernardin here in New York. His most recent book is the companion to his TV show, Avec Eric. We're happy to share this conversation with you now as we get ready to kick off our fall edition of Food Fridays. So, as Julia Child, another champion of French food, might have said, bon appétit. So, Jacques, let's start at the beginning, your beginning. Where were you born and where did you discover cooking?
Well, I was born in the 19th century, actually. I was born next to Lyon. My friend, great chef here, you know, Daniel is from Lyon as well, but you'll notice we have the same accent. But I was born in Bourg-en-Bresse, which is a little town next to, very close to Lyon. And my mother had a restaurant there, so since age, I left home when I was 13 to go into apprenticeship. But prior to this, from age 5 or 6, you know, I was in the kitchen there, peeling the asparagus or cleaning the bottle or doing one thing or another. So,
and you moved to Paris. You were how old?
When I went to Paris, I was 17, actually. I left home at 13 to go into apprenticeship, did my apprenticeship, work in another town called Aix-les-Bains, and eventually end up in Paris at 17, yes.
With the intention of becoming a chef?
Well, I had been working already 5 years.
I mean, you also like art. You like to do other things?
Yeah, I like to do other things, but I mean, basically, at that time, we had kind of blinders. I mean, my father was a cabinet maker. My mother at a restaurant with a chef. I thought that the world of restaurant was more exciting than cabinet making. And frankly, I never thought that I could become a doctor, a lawyer. It wasn't part of the family. We had kind of blinders, so we went in the direction of the family. So I jumped into the oven, and that's it.
And how soon after you arrived in Paris at 17 did you start working at some of the top restaurants of the day, the Plaza Athénée, Maxime's, Fouquet's?
Like the day after?
Really, the day?
Yes.
Immediately?
No, you know, yeah, there's an organization in Paris, which we should have in this country, which we don't, which is called Organisation Les Cuisiniers de Paris, the chef of Paris. So you go there and you wait in line. I mean, when you're a member of it, you are, categorized whether you're a commis, a chef de partie, or whatever your position is, and you can go get a job for the day, for 2 days, for 3 days. If people have you have a restaurant, one of your cooks doesn't come, you call, they send you a guy right away. So I went there and I had a job the day after, yes.
Daniel, like, imagine you don't do that in your restaurants in this country.
No, but I can definitely refer to what Jack is saying, because I'm from Lyon as well.
Now, Lyon is a great food city. Was that part of why? Well, you grew up in a farm, so
absolutely.
Was that that probably was the
but
first important
in
influence?
In Lyon, same thing. We had it was almost like a trading floor, like in Wall Street, the trading floor, but it was for chef. And the chef will go there and look where there could be a job or where there would be an opportunity or anything to do. And so I think Jacques went through the same path in Paris. Yeah. But I think being from Lyon, we were talking just before we came on stage about his mother, Jacques' mother, who had a small restaurant where most of the hookers were on that street too. And
Is that why it was called Le Pelican?
Le Pelican, right.
Rue Thomasin. It was very famous in Lyon. Yeah. And not only Jacques' mother knew every lady there working, and they will come in the morning, they wouldn't be so busy, so they will help his mother doing the vegetable and all that.
That's true.
They really knew how to shell peas.
Yeah. There was a river next to, there is two rivers in Lyon. the Saône and the Rhône. We say in Lyon there are three rivers, the Saône, the Rhône, and the Beaujolais, right? But along the Saône River, there is a market starting like 3 o'clock in the morning until 11. And that's what we did before we went to school. My two brothers and I, it may sound very romantic now, but it wasn't, walking the market because we didn't have a car. My mother would walk the market and buy on her way back, buy a case of a tomato because it was getting too ripe and she knows she had to sell it, so she would get it for a better price and get home and cook for the day and start the day after because there was no refrigeration. We had a glacier, which was a box, you know, with a block of ice for the fish and the meat, but only for the day. So everything was done every day, that's the way it was, you know. So.
Danielle, how old were you when you started going into restaurants to work?
14, and I was carrying the vegetable as well, like Jacques, yeah. Except he was not my mother, he was my boss.
And you were a finalist in a competition for Best Culinary Apprentice.
Well, that,
what kind of competition is there for an apprentice?
No, after 3 years, you pass an exam, and we were 170-something to pass the exam that year in Lyon, and I finished in the top 10. So from that, you qualified for the Best Apprentice of France. You do a regional and a national competition. But the fact that I had a big argument with my chef, I never really went any further after that. So,
oh. You had arguments with your chef?
Yeah, he was a bastard. And I knew it, and the guy was just good, but not good enough to treat me the way he was treating me. And my boss was really good to me, but my chef was not always good. And one time we had a big fight, and he said, well, I will not help you doing this competition. You'll do it on your own. And I felt, and rather than do it on my own and not be good enough, I don't go there.
Well, you then went to work for some of the most famous chefs in France, Roger Verger, mm-hmm. Georges Blanc, Michel Gérard, the creator of La Nouvelle Cuisine.
Right.
No? So, but you never went the Nouvelle Cuisine route, did you?
Me?
Yeah.
Of course, I was on the route of Nouvelle Cuisine every day. I mean, I could, and there was always conversation in the kitchen about other chefs being a little more, less conventional, than maybe, I mean, already there were some avant-gardists, certainly, and Alain Sandorance was part of that. There was also, chef who will be, what was his name in Paris? He had a very modern restaurant.
There were a number of
but anyway,
good chefs in Paris.
And there were some chefs who really during that time were trying to be more eccentric than nouveau. Mm-hmm. And but Michel Gérard was certainly a precursor of a much more clean, refined, personalized, and very fresh. The cuisine sort of had a certain freshness, which maybe was kind of sometimes lost a little bit in the older cuisine.
Now, Eric, you grew up on the Mediterranean first in Antibes. But then, that's a far cry from Lyon, but near the sea, is that where you first became interested in cooking seafood?
Well, for people in the south, Lyon is considered the north.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, like, right. For my grandparents, when they were talking
but it's the north of the south.
Yeah. After Valence, it's Lyon, and it's really remote from the south. However, I was born in Antibes, and I grew up in Saint-Tropez, and my grandmother was living in Cannes. And another one in Nîmes in Provence. And I grew up eating a lot in the kitchens to the point that I was spending so much time eating, I was a bad student. And such a bad student that at 15, I ended up in the office of the principal with my mom. And they said, you cannot go to school any longer. I mean, you have to find what they call a vocational school or something like that. And I was delighted because I wanted to go to culinary school to eat. and then I discovered that you have to cook and work hard in the schools.
Now, I don't normally think of France as having culinary schools. The usual traditional way of learning how to cook, I gather, is represented by these other two gentlemen, starting in restaurants and working your way up. Are there a lot of culinary schools in France, or is it only reform schools where you learn how to cook?
No. I mean, I went to a good school. It was in Perpignan, and I graduated from the school, and after that, I moved to Paris. I was 17 years old and worked in a very classic restaurant called La Tour d'Argent. In 1982, they were celebrating 400 years anniversary. And that was the beginning of my professional life in real kitchens. Although before I did a couple of trainings with the culinary school that were very interesting, where I learned the hard way that you don't want to piss off your chef because he can be violent and go after you and run and you know.
You're not like me.
You also worked for Joël Robuchon.
After La Tour d'Argent, yes, I worked with Joël Robuchon, and that was really for me a revelation. And also, I mean, I was young, I was almost 19, and it was a very, very difficult kitchen to work in because of his rigor, and he was very demanding. I did survive that time. And then I went to do my military duties, and I was really planning to be the chef of the officers, the colonel. But the food was so bad that I went to see the colonel, and I begged him to take me out of that kitchen. Actually, we had the first day of my day in with the officers, we had calamari à l'American. American sauce is, you know, a lobster sauce. And the American sauce was bechamel with ketchup and cognac. So I said to the colonel, I said, listen, I don't mind to do my duties, but I can't serve shit food like that. So I ended up being the waiter.
Now, you were a waiter.
I was the waiter of the colonel, yeah. The same one.
You have the recipe?
Now, before we get to the circumstances of what led you to leave France, let's talk a bit about the French culinary training. How does a chef get trained there? I mean, when you started as apprentices, did they first just have you chop up stuff, or did they actually trust you to do something?
Well, I think if you're in the right place, you're going to have a program. An apprenticeship is 3 years. And my dream is to bring back apprenticeship in America and have the validation of that, just like a school in a way. But it's a 3 years program, and at the time, and you worked every day from 8:30 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. Come back at 5, and finish at 10:30, 11, and then twice a week going to school as well.
That's a long day.
So they were the school part where you had to do the theory and all the you had to learn everything about the classic dishes, and then you had to practice that in the restaurant you worked. And so if you were in a good restaurant, they will make you practice basically the entire curriculum. And so you start as a very young cook doing some small tasks, but then after you grow pretty quickly into responsibility. I mean, the labor was cheap at the time because I was making the equivalent of $1 a month. And I'm not like the generation of Jacques, so I don't know, Jacques, how much you were making, but you must have been making 10 cents.
No pay. No. We were not paid. And we did a lot of cleaning. And we got kicked in the rear end a lot. More than the... There was not any formal learning this way. You start... As I say, doing a great deal of cleaning, and eventually start doing vegetable and start doing. It is not a now much more. We teach the people, we show them, we explain, as you do with your cook. During my time, you learn by osmosis. You steal it. No one tell you anything. The chef never tell you anything anyway. So you did something.
Well,
if you were to ask, what is that sauce? It's a sauce nonut or some stupid thing which means absolutely nothing. So you learn by a type of osmosis, and somehow after a year, like this, the chef told you, you start tomorrow at the stove. Until I was at the stove, my name was you. Then after it was Jacques. And somehow I knew how to do it. You know, you have that type of learning, which is quite different than the way we do now.
So. Now, all of you have worked under great chefs. Is it possible to achieve what you have without having had that experience?
I'm sure.
I think it's possible too.
I think it's possible, obviously, but it's better to work for a great chef,
right?
Because you're gonna learn a lot under the mentorship of that chef, and therefore you're not spending years doing the same thing, peeling carrots. If the chef is good, he's going to move you around if you have talent and so on. And I think it's a must to go work for great chefs, even today, especially today. After the school, when you graduate, or if you haven't graduated, it's a great idea to go work for a very good chef like Daniel.
I would advise
Thomas and
the student at the school I teach in New York to go to a good restaurant. If you work with Eric or if you work with Daniel, I mean, all you have to say is yes, chef. That's about all you have to say. And what the idea there is to look at the way it's done. This is not your idea. And you have to kind of absorb all that knowledge and that knowledge through the head of a chef like Daniel, where you can see his sense of aesthetic, his sense of taste, and you absorb this. Whether you agree with him or not, it's totally material. Then you do that with another chef like Eric and maybe another one, and after 8-10 years, you have absorbed an enormous amount of material. Then now you are, excuse the pun, but you're going to regurgitate that thing, but now you're going to filter it through your sense of aesthetic, your sense of taste. That's when you come into being, but not before that. Because eventually you cannot escape yourself. You have to do what you are meant to be, you know, I think.
Jacques, didn't you cook for 3 French heads of state? Was de Gaulle a picky eater?
I was introduced a while ago and they said that man cooked for 3 heads of state. The 3 of them are dead. Yeah, so. Had nothing to do with it. I was there with Jean-Claude. No, well, at that time, certainly with the de Gaulle government, I spoke with Madame de Gaulle once a week. You know, we did the menu for the week. And usually on Sunday, there was a big meal, 10, 12 people, children, grandchildren. After church, they were very devout Catholic. And so after church, there was the Dominican meal. And that would be very classic, very simple. And too, when it came to state dinner, like I served Nehru, Tito, Eisenhower, that was done by the protocol. You had someone coming, depending on the importance of the dinner, how long it should be, not to duplicate the same meal 3 times or the same dish or the same fish, whatever, 3 times. So that's the way it worked, basically. But I think it was kind of a very classic, simple, very focused type of cuisine, which is different than what we do now.
But you also had to adjust. Nehru would have been a vegetarian, no?
Sorry?
Wouldn't Nehru have been a vegetarian?
Nehru would have been a vegetarian. That's what we did. Usually, if you have a head of state coming, you try to show off the type of cuisine that you do, whatever country you're in, with that taking into consideration, not giving, beef to the Prime Minister of India and a roast of pork to the King of Morocco. But usually the protocol will tell you that. You know.
Now, what led you to come to America? Did you plan to stay here for a long time?
No, actually, I thought I'd come a couple of years and learn the language and leave. I mean, my parents had a restaurant. I mean, most people who come to America, but I don't think it's our case, come from economic reason to have a better life, or racial reason, or political reason, or any of those. I mean, it wasn't my case, and I'm sure it wasn't yours as well. I came here, I said, I'll stay a year, 2 years. From the first day I was in New York, I loved it, so I never went back. That was about the end of it, you know.
Danielle, you came here to take a job in Washington?
Yeah, no, I was there for 2 years. And
that was as a private chef.
Private chef. So that was the sabbatical of the restaurant after I had 11 years of cooking. And then, came to New York and just like Jack, never left.
Are there useful things to be learned when you work as a personal chef?
Well, it's... that was not my type of... I think it's like Jack when he worked with a president or somebody. I think there's a lot of rigor in the sense of you cannot be too creative or too out of the box. And also there's always constrained within the menu or the diet or the family. And so you have to always follow that. So for a while, I think it's interesting. For me, it was my first sort of solo cooking. So it was interesting to recap a little bit on things. And you usually do a cooking which is an hybrid of what you learn and what is the man to do. And then little by little, I think you develop a style from it. But 2 years was enough.
And did you think you'd go back to France?
Not right away. No, I wanted to be in New York. And then 10 years later, I wanted to go back to France. But no, that was for me, first step was to discover, to be able to, and I mean, to discover New York. I had the chance to work at La Côte Basque during the 82, that was in 82. And there was an amazing brigade of young American chefs there. And I was stunned by the energy. The food was his style. It was very good. It was French, but not so French from France, from what I've learned at, you know, Michel Gérard or Roger Verger. But still, he was he had a lot of character in his cuisine, and he was just buying the best ingredient, and it was a big, busy restaurant. Right across from the Saint-Régis. And so I spent a month there. And after that month, I really felt, I think I need to come back to New York for sure.
Now, Eric, you also went to D.C. before you came to New York.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go, you worked at one of the legendary restaurants in Washington, Jean-Louis Peladan's restaurant at the Watergate.
Yes.
Was that what brought you over? Did he go to France and say, come and join me?
No, actually, I wanted to leave Joël Robuchon's kitchen at Jamin. And,
he was crying every day.
He found out I wanted to leave, so he took me to his office and he said, I heard you want to leave and I would like to help you. Where do you want to go? And I said, Brazil. And he laughed at me. And he said, no, you're not going on vacation. And so then I said Spain. And at that time, I was living in Andorra, which is between France and Spain. It's a very, very small country.
Lived there for a while when you were a kid?
Yes, from 9 to 17. And he said, no, it's too close to your house. So finally, I said, well, send me anywhere you want. And he sent me to Jean-Louis Paladin. And I arrived at, I was 22 years old when I started at Jean-Louis. And I was very happy because Jean-Louis was from Gascony. And I thought he would speak in French to me. I didn't speak a word of English. And he spoke his kind of English to me. And I didn't understand anything for 3 months in that kitchen. But that was the beginning in Washington.
Was working there in a French restaurant similar to working in a French restaurant in France, because Daniel said that it was different here, wasn't it?
Yeah, but my conviction for me to stay in America was Jean-Louis, and I think Eric can explain why, because the way he was working and the food he was making there.
Oh, that was a great
restaurant.
It was
really in total relation with what was going on in France at that time.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, when I started at Jean-Louis, I was very impressed with the quality of the products. Jean-Louis was mentoring farmers, and he was going in Maine, and he was talking to the fishermen and to the scuba divers to go get scallops by hand for him and get sea urchins and so on. So when I started at Jean-Louis, I was very impressed with the quality of the products. Although Robuchon had also fantastic ingredients to begin with, but it was a very different atmosphere in the kitchen. Robuchon was very regimented, very disciplined, and we were 25 cooks for 40 covers. And I don't know if you know that, but Robuchon wanted to be a priest when he was young.
I didn't know.
And he was kind of a priest. The good aspect of it. No, don't get confused. It's not what I'm saying. But then I end up with Jean-Louis Paladin, and it's like this guy with long hair looking like a hippie, and it's basically Woodstock in his kitchen, and and he has a small team, and he does 45 covers, and every night is a different menu, and he's improvising every day, and Robuchon, you know, we will take months to put a dish together, and when we will have it, we will keep it consistent. With Jean-Louis, everything was changing every day. I was really challenged by that.
Now, another French chef, a friend, said that he preferred American kitchens because they were more democratic. Did you have that experience?
Democratic in which way?
Well, of course, you run your own kitchen, so you could be as democratic or dictatorial as you wish, but is there a different atmosphere in American kitchens?
Yes. Well, it depends. I think today, the French kitchen has always been with a certain discipline and a certain regimen where it's not always for everybody. Plus, there is a little bit of that sometimes French attitude in the kitchen, which you don't really bring here and it don't do too well here. But when you put a bunch of French together, there's plenty of French attitude.
You came here and worked at the Pavillon, which was at that time the standard of French cooking in America.
In 1959, I worked at the Pavillon. It was still very classic and very structured, but certainly much more democratic than in France. The first thing to start with is that we did the day in one shift. As Daniel explained before, the classic way was starting in the morning around 8:30, 9 o'clock. After the noon meal until 2 o'clock, then you have a break from 2 to 5. You start at 5 until 10:30. So basically, your day is very long. Here, we started either in the morning, then I was the night chef. I start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and finish at 10 o'clock at night. One shift morning, so I started doing a great thing, other thing. I went to Colombia and all that because I had so much more time and, much more democratic than in France at that time.
What were the biggest culture shocks for you when you first arrived? Eric? Well, of course, you were working for a French chef and you couldn't understand a word he was saying, so...
Well, that was definitely...
And then you couldn't speak English yourself. Was that... Did that make life very difficult?
And on top of it, I was living on 13 and whatever letter.
And P?
And I couldn't say 13. And the cab driver would always, like, spend 5 minutes with me to know where I was going. But anyway... If I may go back to the difference in between the U.S. and France, in France, abuse was part of the education. And I'm not even trying to be funny. but in France, when you go into a kitchen, they humiliate you, and the idea is to break you, to rebuild you as a good cook.
As one of them. Absolutely.
And so therefore, there's a lot of abuse, and sometimes it's physical, but not in the face, but in the shoulders. And actually, my nickname was Blue Shoulders. It's verbal abuse, and the chefs scream. And I have to say, I mean, the chefs are little at that time, we're little dictators.
Well, maybe the place you were working, too.
Probably, yes. I'm sure for you it was Walt Disney.
Yeah.
But when I came to the U.S., it was very different. Although Jean-Louis could have his moments, it was much more respectful in the U.S. And
Jean-Louis was a madman in the kitchen, mad in a way of...
But fun.
Absolutely. Right. Of like being so possessed by his food.
Yes.
I think it was like fascinating.
A friend who, another chef, an American chef, said he worked in a French restaurant here, and the chef would yell at him, stupid, idiot, you know, and all these terrible names, and he was always afraid he was going to be fired. Other people kept on leaving, and he remained, so he figured he couldn't have been that stupid and that much of an idiot, but that was the way the chef talked to everybody.
Has changed today,
for sure. Changed. I mean, I don't think that it's the same any longer, but yet, in the kitchen, the chef is the chef, just like on a boat, the captain... You know, lead the boat. In the kitchen, it's a teamwork where everyone does what the chef wants. That's what the teamwork is, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Being inspired by the French education in the kitchen, when I started to be a chef at Le Bernardin in 1991, I was I had my little moments and tantrums and breaking plates and yelling at the cooks. And I realized that I was very unhappy to be angry. As you can imagine, you cannot mix happiness and anger. And on top of it, I lost most of my team. And therefore, I learned a great lesson that you have to mentor and make sure you nurture your team, because a cook who's shaking like that is not going to do a better job than a cook who's inspired to cook for the client, right? So that was a great lesson.
But I think the most thriving thing in the kitchen is to really rally and pull and rally and really push with the team together. I think the greatest satisfaction for the team and for the chef is when you really feel that, you know, there's one team pushing in one direction and succeeding together.
Yes, when you look at television and you see those cooking shows, everyone is screaming and yelling too. This is what television is. They need that for television. But if you go in his kitchen or in his kitchen or Thomas Keller, you'll be surprised there is no noise. Nothing. There is the order come, the chef called the order, everyone is in his place work. No one wants to do television this way. It's not exciting. No one is yelling their head up or too insulting too. But that's the way it is in a good kitchen. You don't have any of that tantrum. And then there's a great deal of love, you know, regardless of what you said, to put in the food along with your technique and your talent. So, you know, not by yelling at someone, you make him get better. It doesn't work out this way, you know. It used to be this way.
Do all the French chefs know each other? Do they kind of hang out together?
I'm assuming that it's an opportunity to talk about food and speak in French.
No, I think
in pas français.
No. But if we are the three of us, we speak French. Otherwise, no. I think the fraternity in America among chefs is fabulous. And it's not about being French or being any American or Asian. I think there's a great fraternity, and I think we all learn from each other, which I think is very interesting here.
But it has changed a great deal. I came here in 1959, as I said. I worked at the Pavillon a little bit, and then I worked for Howard Johnson for like 10 years. When I finished in 1970, I opened a restaurant on Fifth Avenue. By then, I had never met a white American chef. All the chefs I knew in New York were either French, Italian, Spanish, Swiss, whatever. And all the chefs that I knew, American chefs, were the black kid that I met at Howard Johnson. You had to wait until the mid-70s, beginning Nouvelle Cuisine, thing exploded, start changing. But before that, there was no white American chef that I knew of.
Were people surprised when you went to Howard Johnson?
Well, Mr. Johnson, Howard D. Johnson, the father who created the company, was a client of the Pavillon, and he always tell Pierre Frenet, who was the executive chef, and I work with Pierre, that we're going to work for him one day. And it was another world. And actually, in the spring of 1960, I was offered the job at the White House for Kennedy, and I went to Howard Johnson. because, again, I had been chef of the president in France. I'd never been on a newspaper, magazine, television did not exist. In fact, no one ever called you to have kudos to you, or you never went to the dining room or any of that stuff. The chef was really much lower as it is now on the social scale. Any good mother would have wanted her child to marry a doctor and a lawyer, not a cook. But now we are genius. See, it's different. At that time, so when I was offered the job at the White House, I had no idea of the potential for publicity. And I say, I've done that type of stuff.
You learned quickly.
Yeah, I've done that. But at Howard Johnson, I learned about mass production, chemistry of food, you know, marketing. I mean, I opened La Potagerie. I was a consultant at the Russian Tea Room. I opened the World Trade Center with Joe Baum. I could never have done those things without Howard Johnson.
Now, I once asked you and Julia Child which one of you was more of a French purist, and you both agreed that she was.
Yes, she was. She was. She said, "This is not the way you do it."
Okay. Because you,
give them more, Julia.
Yeah, right.
Because you really became more Americanized than a lot of other chefs.
Yes,
that came
maybe.
Up?
I remember one time we did a show on hamburger. You know, I did my hamburger like at Howard Johnson, a thin hamburger. It's about the only meat that I don't put any salt before I cook it. I always put it, but they are not. Then without pressing it on the stove, and I had a bun which was grilled. I had lettuce. I had tomato, a slice of onion, and so forth. She took her hamburger meat. She sautéed some onion, mixed it with the hamburger meat, chopped it up. I mean, together like a meatloaf. Put it very flat in a skillet, sautéed it like a meatloaf. You know, put it on the thing the way we used to do hamburger in France. Totally different. So we argue, but we always finish with a bottle of wine anyway. So.
Do American diners expect different things than French diners do?
Sorry?
Do American diners expect different things than French diners do? And I wonder, because you've experienced it in France and here, but I'm sure there are French people come to your restaurant as well.
No, often is the French diner we expect always something more or something, you know, I mean, I remember today, I think to be a diner with an opinion, I think you have to be able to patronize the restaurant and know the chef well and his cooking to really maybe have an opinion and say, well, I think then, you know, I mean, to really analyze somebody's cooking, I think you have to know his cooking. Mm-hmm. And the French often, they weren't really, I mean, the French type of customer I grew up with, they were very consistent. They will come 2-3 times a week in the same restaurant all the time, or they will, you know, travel and stop always at the same place. And so it was sort of what we call the regulars, and those regulars, of course, start to build up a little bit of opinion about the place. Right. Either they are very happy to find the recipe they love the most, or they...
You mean they order the same dish every time?
Sometimes they could, or sometimes they don't. It don't matter. I mean, it depends the time of the year. But yeah. I
think French people are more difficult to please, in general, in restaurants than American. In fact, you go in Europe. I mean, I am a culinary director of a cruise line, Oceania Cruise Line. There is absolutely no question when they do survey and they have Europeans coming on board from the Italian, the French and all that, they like the American much more. They went in term very much less complaint. People are, I don't know, more ready to be happy or to be satisfied in general. Do you think so?
What about service?
But it's difficult to compare to that because I think now, you know, compared to the generation when I learned how to cook, and today, where if I go to a bistro in France and I think the bistro is lousy because it has no more soul or it has no more, you know, and then I'm really unhappy and I'm becoming that, you know, American who have the right to complain about the French.
Now, the two of you have restaurants. Do you train your staff? I mean, is it important for the chef to get the staff to interact well with the customers?
Are you talking about the front of the house?
I'm talking about in a restaurant on the level of Le Bernardin or Daniel, or where you expect service to be really good, and then I go to a restaurant, I'm not saying yours, and the waiter comes over and says, so how are things going, guys?
That's definitely not us.
But is it the chef's responsibility?
At Le Bernardin, they say, is the fish fresh for you enough?
It's of course, it's our, in many, I mean, first of all, Daniel and I, we are chef owners. So mm-hmm. Therefore, we have to take care not only of the kitchen, but of the entire restaurant. And it's our duty to make sure that everything goes fine from the beginning, which is the kitchen, and until the end, which is when the waiter is serving the plate. So, and I know Daniel is very involved with every aspect of his restaurant, and I do the same. I'm very involved with training the staff in the dining room, training obviously the cooks, yeah, and even the people on the phone. Because when you call a restaurant like Daniel or ours, you have expectations from the first 30 seconds that the telephone rings. You expect someone to pick up the phone and to be courteous, and you don't want to someone to say, "Well, no, okay, I'll do it." You need someone, you know, someone. So we are very involved in all those little details that makes a restaurant potentially at the top.
Now, how important are, first of all, are reviewers different in France than they are in this country?
I'm going to say something.
Yeah?
What I love about this country is that most of the journalists who come in a restaurant pay their bill.
That's good.
And I appreciate that very much. And then they can say whatever they want.
Well, they don't want you to know who they are also, but you always know who they are.
I'm sorry?
They don't want you to know who they are. They often come in disguise. But you usually know who they are, don't you?
Yes, but for instance, if a journalist comes in at 1 o'clock and wants to be served, and your sauce is mediocre, your fish is lousy, the vegetables are burnt, what are you going to do? It's nothing. It's too late. Even if you recognize the journalist, he's going to choose whatever he wants. Mm-hmm. The journalists in France, they have the magazines and newspapers and so on have very small budgets, and very often the journalists cannot do their job well, so they have to be invited, and I don't like that.
You don't have a restaurant in France.
Your colleague, Andre Soltner, tells the story of coming here not speaking English and working at Lutèce, uh-huh. being hired at Lutèce, and he gets a review from Craig Claiborne, 1 star, and everybody is very sad for him, and he says, 1 star, that's great, you know, because Michelin, 1 star is perfectly fine. And then the next week, Craig Claiborne gives 2 stars to Chock Full of Nuts, and that's... And that's when he realized that, well, he was in trouble. He did okay eventually.
But I think there is much more cooperation between the kitchen and dining room now. I mean, I was a kid, it was like war between the dining room and the kitchen. No one talked to one another. Certainly, another part of it, the chef would never do anything about wine or decide on wine with a sommelier, regardless of what he ate. Now the chef decide on what should be served with his food. He teach the people in the dining room, make sure to this, that should be served with this. Much more cooperation, don't you think?
Of course, I mean, there's a choreography written every day about the service and about who is coming to eat and what is the plan and where people are seated and what are we planning to do for the evening and what are the new dishes. And we have about 45 minutes to rally together everybody in order to make sure they're into everybody knows their play.
Every day you do that.
Yeah.
Every day you bring. Good. Yeah,
before service. So.
Now, Danielle and Eric, your restaurants have both received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times. They've been named 2 of the top French restaurants in the world. Do you see any irony in the fact that you've been named leading French chefs for what you've created in the United States?
I didn't understand. We're mainly French chefs?
Yeah. Well, no. I don't... have you ever wondered what would have happened if you'd gone back and opened restaurants in France?
No, we are the proud ambassadors. That's all. I think that's enough. But I would love to be in France, too. I mean, I think we will have done well. I think we will have done very well. Eric will be in Andorra, near the Spanish border. I'll be in Lyon.
Yeah, certainly. Well,
you wouldn't be cooking fish, would you?
Yeah. Anchovy a lot.
Well, we have trout.
Did you cook a lot of fish before you... You didn't specialize in fish before you came to Le Bernardin.
Well, when I got out of culinary school and I went to La Tour d'Argent, although it was specialized in ducks, I was in a fish station. And then when I went to Jamin with Royal Robuchon, the first time I went, I was on a garde-manger. And then after my military duties, I ended up on a fish station again. When I went with Jean-Louis, who was very good with game, I was taking care of the fish as well.
A predilection there.
And I went with, I was sous chef for David Boulet for a short period of time. And I was in a fish station as well. So then when Le Bernardin called, I was like, yeah, this is easy, it's fish.
How often do you go back? Do you go back, all of you, to France? And I mean, Danielle, you said that sometimes you find a really bad restaurant, but there are some really great restaurants.
No, man.
Do you go back to find out what's going on, to steal recipes? Or are they coming to you to steal your recipe?
I don't know if it's about steal recipe or no. It's more about enjoying a moment who take us back home. I think it's very important. And I think it don't matter which country you go. If you are born and raised there and you go back, there is certain things will bring you back all kind of memories about food, about life. And, of course, generation after generation, things change a little bit. But there is always chefs who try to bring back what the past taught us and try to preserve a little bit of the past as well, which I think is important.
Yeah, I go back to France usually once a year, see my mother. Now I would raise my glass to my mother. She's 98 years old today. So. the 16th. So, yes. But there are different type of restaurants. You know, the type of restaurant that we learn classically, it's a type of knowledge that you can carry with you to go back to your, to saying, you know, can you do that in France or in America? Because after working with so many chefs, you have that type of knowledge that you can carry with you. Opposed to certain restaurants in France, you have restaurants, you know, the Michelin is only part of about 600-700 restaurants in France, and there is 146,000 restaurants in France also. The type of cuisine that you may have in the country, which is passed from mother to daughter, a kind of earth, whatever grows there at that point, they're very minimally cooking, a few dishes which they do over and over again. That type of cuisine is more difficult to duplicate than what we have learned in another way.
And, right? And also, I think in France, we have sort of the order of the craft, and that's the meilleur ouvrier de France, where in order to become a meilleur ouvrier de France, you have to master your craft. And it's basically a competition of chefs, but it is for boulanger, pâtissier, cuisinier, chocolatier, glacier,
jeweler, cabinet maker.
This is what maybe maintain the tradition, maintain also the education, and maintain the fraternity among chefs. Sometimes it's a bit of a mafia, but at the same time, and that's not mean because you're mayor way at France, then you're going to be the smartest businessman in the world. You definitely were a very good French chef, but does not mean that maybe you catch the new wave of evolution with the French cuisine as well. But often I think it's something who, in America, yet we haven't found the real reference to the person who is really into his craft with the cuisine and the recompense of that. I mean, the compensation from that learning and passing this competition. I mean, it's 700 chefs every two years. It's 700 chefs who are applying, or 800 chefs, and out of that, they're going to only select maybe 8, 6 to 10, depends on the year, as meilleur ouvrier de France. So it's really, and they're cooking, everybody's cooking the same dish. Everybody has the same recipe and the same dish. And of course, there is also some test on your knowledge. But just to show it, and it's not like, okay, we give you a basket of vegetable and do whatever you want and we'll think then you're the best. It's then you have to be the best of the best at one thing.
Yes, it would be interesting to do Iron Chef like that in this country.
Sorry?
It would be interesting to have Iron Chef do that one, where everybody has to cook the same dish.
But our generation, we didn't have time to do that. But Joël Robuchon is a typical example of a meilleur ouvrier de France. And there's many other competition of where you really have to be a chef at the highest level, like Prix Tétinger also, where also the same way, they have very little freedom in creating. I mean, we do the Bocuse d'Or, which is this international competition, but there's many competitions which are just French, and hopefully we'll bring a couple of them here. I think it'd be nice to see Prix Tétinger here. And
this is what we are talking about here, it's craftsmanship. craftsmanship is extremely important in France. So you have to go through those long period of craftsmanship. If you happen not to have too much talent, you can still run a kitchen. But I know a fair amount of chefs who are very good craftsmen. They run a kitchen. Their hands move very fast. They are very good technicians. And they're relatively lousy cook. The food is okay, but never extraordinary. You know, not extraordinary all over. But first, you have to become a technician. If you happen to have talent, you take that talent and that knowledge and a bit of love, and you have that knowledge in your hand, you know, to take it on a much higher level. But here we haven't really emphasized too much the craftsmanship of it. More innovation, creativity, often sometimes which lead to nowhere because there is no craftsman behind, there is no structure, there is no classicism behind. So that's an important thing.
Now, is that craftsmanship something you're trying to impart with your cooking shows? Because you've written a number of books
Technique is important. Yeah. That's part of it. Yeah, that's right.
And Eric, you also show people how to cook. What are you hoping to do there, to teach people how to think about cooking?
Yes, I do that obviously at the restaurant, but through books, on television, using the media, and sharing the knowledge about craftsmanship and passion for cooking, which is very important. And then craftsmanship is basically the base of the pyramid. If you want to be able to cook at a very high level, potentially, you have to master the basics. And when you have the master craftsmanship, then if you have talent, you can start to be creative and have an understanding of what you are doing and be able to be consistent as well. If not, you can be lucky one day and have a good sauce, the day after, bad day, bad sauce, and you don't even understand why. So craftsmanship is key for someone who wants to cook well.
Now, Danielle, on your television show, you don't cook, you eat with friends. That sounds like more fun.
Which one? Eric's show?
On your show.
Oh. Your television show.
Oh, After Hours?
You don't do cooking on your television show.
Oh, a good show.
I do cooking. I do the cooking, and I sit down and eat it with my friends, yeah. That was my show, After Hours. And I was always doing big dishes, the things you would never do on the menu because it only feed 8 or 10 people or 12. But I think mentorship also is important, and that's why once you have an employee who has really loyalty to you, I think you really develop a mentorship with them, then it's unique. The relationship is unique.
I just want to know from each of you, what are your guilty pleasures in terms of American food? Is there...
Listen, guilty pleasure for me doesn't exist, especially when we talk about food. Food, I mean, when you eat, it's about pleasure. And I don't understand why someone will have any kind of guilt when it's about...
Okay.
Right? I mean, it's something that...
Well, the reason I mention that is... I was talking to a chef who worked for Alain Ducasse, and he said when he first came to America, he fell in love with pastrami, and he taught himself how to make pastrami.
Fantastic.
And then he went back to France to work at one of the Ducasse restaurants, and he said to all of his French friends, "Isn't this great?" And they all looked at it like, "You're crazy." So that didn't stop him from loving pastrami, but it was something he had to keep to himself and his family.
Right.
No, I can't imagine anybody not liking pastrami, but that's a whole other matter.
Exactly.
Is there an American food that you particularly like that you wouldn't have even known about if you hadn't come here?
I know what I like and love in American food, and I know also what I dislike a lot, which is processed food and what we can...
Did you ever eat
spam? And junk food. And
did you eat spam?
Actually, I ate spam.
Because I never ate spam.
I did. cooked by Puerto Ricans, and they do a sofrito, and they make a miracle, they make it good. But I don't like junk food, and I don't like processed food, and I don't eat that, and everything else. Whatever I eat is what I love, and I'm happy to eat it, and go to bed after or go somewhere else and happy.
If you love it, why would you be guilty?
How much of the food you eat, Jacques, would be called American food, and how much would be still in a French style.
Well, it's interesting because I have a book here, Sacha Blanc, which is 700 recipes, and sometimes people will look at me on the quintessential French chef. Well, on page 32, let's say I have a black bean soup with banana and cilantro on two. Next to it, fried chicken, southern style. You know, this is a reflection of my life in the last half a century, 50 years. So I don't really think in terms of French or American. I don't try to be French, and I don't try not to be French. I don't really think in those terms. I like something to eat, I do it, I cook, I mix, I mean, from cilantro to many other things that I've never used in France. So it's kind of behind the point for me.
Danielle, Chinese food, Mexican food?
Burger, banger. I mean, whatever I'm doing at DBGB is really an extension of my passion for fast food in a sense of like, we do a hot dog, we make the hot dog ourselves, we make the bread, we make everything. And to me, having the quintessential junk food, if hot dog is junk food, let's say, having the quintessential junk food made with very fresh, high-quality ingredient, I think it's good.
Yeah, okay, well, we have time for some questions. Who's first? Over here. Go ahead.
So the question came up about the difference between diners in England, in US and diners in France. For me, I've grown up between the two countries, and I've always felt in France the meal is the entertainment for the evening. You know, I plan to spend my whole evening eating. It's not like in between drinks and a party.
And no phone.
Yeah. And I wondered whether you felt that that difference still exists, that in France there's more a sense of that's the pinnacle and the most exciting thing happening to me today, and whether you'd vary how you serve food to a French diner who's like, I want to spend 5 hours and that's my thing, versus someone who's going to a meeting afterwards.
I think the art of dining, I mean, dining is an art as well, and one require... of course, patient when require great food, but also great wine and great conversation, great friends. And I think that's what the French stand the most for, is the time you spend together is so valuable, because it is about the people, it's about the food, it's about the wine. And it can be a very humble meal. It can be a very humble meal, but it's an important moment. And I think for any parents, when they have this privilege to share with their children a privileged moment, I think it's the same as well.
And do you think that doesn't exist then in the States?
It is. Well, I think there's a lot of disturbance today. Everybody has a phone. The kids have an iPad. the TV is on, and... is not always, a lot of people don't know how to cut it off. And I think the biggest thing is to know, to appreciate the privilege of having an intimate and maybe powerful moment around food.
Thank you, Jeff.
Next question.
And that's why when you go to Le Bernardin or Danielle, that's why we try to give you. We try to...
An experience.
Do people take out their cell phones and their iPads in the middle of meals?
Yeah.
We let the hipsters take picture of the food, though. With no flash.
Right. There are restaurants that are now banning taking photographs of the food. Does it bother you?
We do not. If you want to take pictures of your food and make believe that you are...
They charge you at Le Bernardin. They add it up on the bill.
No.
The waiter is counting how many pictures you take. And
no, but if you want to make... I mean, what is hilarious about people taking pictures of their food is that it's to tweet about it and to say how much of a great moment they're having. While they're doing that, they don't talk to their guests.
The next question.
It's a paradox.
Hello.
Thank you.
Currently, what are your favorite places to eat in New York? Present company excluded.
Eric.
Well, it's so many places, I mean, to go. I mean, I go out at least 2 to 3 times a week. And I go to Balthazar once a week. And the family refuse to go with me now because they're tired of it. I do that for 10 years. However, I always try new places, and I visit sometimes places from some friends and so on. You know, I mean, in New York, as you know, every week it's few restaurants opening, and I, out of them, it's two or three at least very interesting. So I try to go to those places. My next destination, if I get a table, is Lafayette. I want to try Alder from a Wiley Dufresne. That's this week.
So for me, I love Aldea, George Mendes, the chef at Aldea. I was last night at Jean-Georges, the new ABC Cucina, where it was, I thought it was Cucina, I couldn't find it on the, but it's Cucina, and it's more the South American journey. And that was very cool, next to ABC Kitchen. And 15 East, the Japanese chef, Masa, here nearby. And many others. Jacques, where do you go?
Korean. I go to, even in Queens now, and Flushing, fantastic Chinese food. But tonight we're eating at DBGB.
Voilà. I know, Jacques had good taste.
Another question.
Somebody once told me that in Europe, the real difference between different regions is not the countries that speak Romance or Teutonic languages, not the Catholic or the Protestant countries, but the places that cook with butter and the places that cook with olive oil. Would you agree with that?
Well, the olive oil starts south of Lyon, so... And we have the right to use olive oil in Lyon too, but it's mostly the south versus the north where, I mean, I worked, it was quite fragrant actually. I mean, I worked at Georges Blanc in the Bresse and we were using maybe, I don't know, 100 pounds of butter a week. I mean, it was just like cooking those, frying those frog legs in butter, and it's nothing more beautiful than foamy butter around the frog legs. You don't see them anymore. The butter is foaming and foaming. And then after, when you receive them on your table, they have at least, there's a cup of butter with the green parsley and garlic, and you get a basket of bread, and you're going to soak that whole butter into your bread and eat it. And there's nothing better than that. So...
That's why you're so thin.
Go ahead.
Mr. Boulou, you might have answered my question already, but I was wondering for each of you if there's a dish that you crave that you used to have in France that you haven't had as well since then.
Well, there's always dish I crave from the memory of taste, because I think we all have craving based on the memory of a dish you had. I have a memory of at Alain Chapelle, for example, and he was doing the gâteau de foie blanc with the crayfish sauce. Mm-hmm. And it was a very humble dish of chicken liver blend with some milk, cream, eggs, and garlic, and custardy a little bit, and this delicate sauce. But it was such an iconic dish. It's there's usually I crave the dish of the chef who already passed away, so because I know it, and like Jean-Louis Paladin, I had amazing dish at Jean-Louis, including he was cooking pibal, baby heels. He was cooking baby heels like no one else. He was from the southwest of France and all that, and I know it, and before I find somebody who cook me baby heel like Jean-Louis, it's gonna take a while.
Do you remember how to do that, Eric?
If I remember to cook
the baby eels?
Yeah.
Are you going to bring them into Le Bernardin?
I have a story about the baby eels because I learned from Jean-Louis how to make them. And basically you throw the baby eels in a pan, hot pan, but they're live.
So they're jumping in the oil.
I was serving them until 3 years ago when I heard some noise coming from the pan. This is a true story. And I am convinced they were screaming. And I swear, and from that day on, I never touch baby eels again. This is a true story.
But now we cannot have baby eel because they cost $3,000 a pound.
Yes.
And it's all Asia. The Japanese market will catch them to raise them, to grow them. And in the old days, they were more than that, and they were only $300 a pound.
Yeah.
Well, for me, if I have the bread that I had as a child, or the greatest bread in the world, and the greatest butter in the world. It's very difficult to beat bread and butter, you know, frankly. You remember those? When we came back from school, we had a piece of bread, the same thing, with a piece of dark chocolate, you know. So that's my memory of, you know, remembering of things past, you know. So,
but I think the most, and I'm sure Jacques has found memory of it, is a delicacy which is totally forbidden and we can't find anymore, and it's called ortolan, basically a little bird fattened like a duck.
Bunting bird. Bunting.
It's an endangered species now.
Endangered species, but 20 years ago you still could get it, 30 years ago. And the privilege to have an ortolan, because you only eat one in your life and that's enough. You remember forever, and it's not like you're popping 12 birds at a time and you're really a bad boy. So, and just the memory of eating that and the taste and the experience is just something who, I don't know, it just throw you somewhere in the past. You feel like maybe you don't know what century you're in or what happened to you, but it's really unique because it's just you and the bird and nothing else, salt and pepper.
I think that for most people, the dish that you remember is something very visceral, you know. Those are the dish of your childhood, you know, the dish that your mother or whatever, those taste. I think there is a Chinese philosopher who say, what is patriotism? Patriotism is the taste of the dishes you had as a child. And there is a great deal of truth in this. Those dishes, you know, will follow you the rest of your life. And when you walk the wood and you smell something, the smell or two in the affective memory of Proust, that will bring you back right there in a very powerful moment, you know. So those dishes of your childhood, you know, stay with you.
And Proust wrote a whole book about that. We have virtually no more time left. I know a lot of people are going to be disappointed. We have time for one more question.
Chef Rupar, several years ago you were paired with a molecular chef who was a contestant on Tom Colicchio's Top Chef program. And I was struck by a quote that you made saying that you have to constantly learn. It's always a learning process. And if you get to a point in your career where you don't think you have any more to learn, you're so arrogant that you're blind. And at the pinnacle of all of your careers, I mean, you're clearly the cynosure of French cuisine in America and Nouveau cuisine in many cases. What continues to inspire and teach each of you? I mean, seemingly you know so much and you've seen so much, but what continues to make you learn? Where do you seek your inspiration?
I think it's very important to keep curiosity, to stay curious and to stay humble and to realize that a lot of people around you are doing great things and be inspired by what they do without copying necessarily what they are doing. But for instance, modernist cuisine, because we don't want to call it molecular anymore, at this moment and fade. However, some of the techniques from molecular and, are today applied in our restaurants to bring some intensity to the food, to bring some lightness to the food, and so on. So I don't know anyone who's more curious than Daniel. I mean, really, and myself, I enjoy exploring new techniques all the time and so on. And that keeps us, relevant in a sense. And, yeah, the day you feel that you are so good, you are such a genius, that you don't have to learn anymore, I mean, your ego is blinding you and basically you're an idiot. Yeah.
Jacques?
Well, I'm always hungry, so as long as I'm hungry... I'm inspired, you know, so as long as I'm hungry, I'll cook. Now, if I don't cook for 3-4 days, you know, I'm somewhere that I kind of feel I need to cook. And I've been married 48 years now, and I don't remember one day in all those times that I didn't sit down for dinner with my wife. We drank one, sometimes two bottles of wine. But after all those years, it's a very, very important part of the day, you know, that day of getting together and eating together. And when my daughter was 4 years old and would get home and ask my wife, Mom, what's for dinner? My wife would say, food. And that's still what we eat. We eat food for dinner. So.
Danielle?
Inspiration, I mean, for me, of course, is traveling, is colleague, is new generation of chef, It's traveling in Charleston or traveling in Scandinavia or traveling in Italy. But where I get the most excitement often is to create a dish for wine and to try to really pair the two, because we do often wine pairing, wine tasting, where the vintage of the wine is 20, 30, 40 years old, and it become very delicate and it become very sensitive. And so you have to create a dish with pairing with it. It's not like below the wine or above the wine. And I think working with the sommelier, especially when you do a big tasting where there is maybe 8 or 10 course going with a lot of wine, it's how do we going to be able to match the perfect dish for that great wine. I think for me it's really exciting. It's really the challenge also.
Do you encourage people in your kitchen to propose food ideas, recipes?
Of course. I mean, it's always a round table when we sit down.
There's that ambitious young chef.
Everybody can come with an idea, but when we start to brainstorm, we have a round table and we start to brainstorm together.
And you're nodding your head, Eric.
No, we do the same. Although, I mean, it's important for us, the mentors, to have the stamp of approval at the end, because it has to stay
in our style.
Teamwork,
where they do what they want.
I want to thank you all for coming out for this WNYC community event.